With that, we'll begin.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Jack Olson, registration number 9475, here for the plaintiff appellant. I don't have a lengthy oral argument because the issues in this case are straightforward and come before the court on a de novo review of a dismissal, again, on a motion to dismiss, in which our view of the prevailing case law is that the facts should have been taken in favor of the plaintiff, the non-movement and movement, and also any reasonable inferences from them. There are two issues that go to the heart of the case, and the first issue is whether the terms of this contract between an employer and an employee were indeed ambiguous to start with, and then if the court finds that they were or are, the next question would be what to do about it. The trial court actually never reached the issue of ambiguity. The trial court, for instance, did not find that the terms were ambiguous. The trial court ruled as a matter of law that the language, as the trial court read it, was not for a term of years, and therefore it did not reduce the requirements of at will employment principle of law as applied to this case. We would respectfully argue that this contract was plainly for a term of 2 years. It didn't say up to 2 years. It didn't say so many dollars per year. It didn't say anything except a certain amount of money per year for 2 years. This is a form of contract that is very, very commonplace, the probably most commonplace form of a contract in America and in the English language. And in a common understanding of the English language, there's no other way to interpret this. If there were, and if this court were to find ambiguity in that wording, it would threaten hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts, including any Denver Nugget basketball contract, because those contracts are worded identically.
Well, counsel, that's outside the record. We're not supposed to take that into consideration.
Thank you. I think that when the court analyzes a contract situation such as this, it not only should, and I know you will, look at the actual wording itself, but any reasonable inferences from the wording, which is a rule of construction that I know and I hope you will apply, because any reasonable inference of this contract is that it was for 2 years, because that's what it said.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Olson. I understand that you think that the language is not ambiguous. United Food Service doesn't think the language is ambiguous either. I'm not saying we're going to do this. This is, at this point, a hypothetical question, but what if we were to decide that the language is ambiguous? What should we do?
I think your Dorman case would control, and indeed the court has called our attention to that case and seems to be right on all fours if it is ambiguous, that it is a fact question for jury determination. And interestingly, the Dorman case has been relied upon by the federal court and the Tenth Circuit court as well for that same principle of law, that if it is ambiguous, it's a fact question for the jury, and certainly not to be determined upon a motion for summary, or I'm sorry, motion to dismiss, when facts should have been taken and inferences therefrom taken in favor of the plaintiff. The trial judge did gravitate to a case that counsel cited, the Justice case, which is in their legal brief. And in reading that case, if you have the opportunity, the language in that case is not close to the language in this case, and certainly not parallel to the language in this case, because the contract in that case said simply an annual salary of $12,000 per year. It didn't say per 2 years or 3 years or for a number of years. It said per year. And of course, that's a common way of speaking in the English language, and it's quite natural that would end up in agreements. But we would concede that that case stands for the principle that if there is no term of years in a contract, then it does not negate or minimize the employment at will concept. But in our case, It's different. It didn't say per year. It said for 2 years. And if that term weren't reasonably interpretable in light of the employee's understanding, this contract would have had no meaning. The dollar amount would have had no meaning, because as soon as he arrived, he could have been fired. And so this fellow moving from one state to another reasonably interpreted that and negotiated it. And then in addition, the term guarantee is woven in to the language of this contract. And
pardon me for interrupting again, Mr. Olson, if I may please, but why doesn't the term guarantee just simply say this, that that what is guaranteed here is if Mr. Pissarro works for UFS for 2 years, we're obligated to pay him at least $100,000 each of those 2 years? Because isn't the word guarantee connected with the money amount?
I think it's connected with every word in that sentence.
I
think it modifies each term in that sentence, and naturally English language it would, or it would have been crafted differently and perhaps with some punctuation. But I do think that this kind of clause needs to be interpreted in light of common sense, common human understanding in the English language. And I hate to say this so strong, but I do not believe it is susceptible to any other interpretation, and therefore is certainly not ambiguous. However, if it is, and the court so finds, then we believe the principle you've enunciated in Dorman would apply. It's a fact issue for the...
So why don't you tell us then why you think Dorman doesn't apply?
Because the provision in the contract is not ambiguous, Your Honor. And Dorman says that if a contract term is ambiguous, and in the Dorman case, I think it was an employment setting, or whatever setting it was, I apologize for not remembering that, that if it is ambiguous, then it's a jury question.
Excuse me, Mr. Olson, I had one question. Under your view of the contract, wouldn't it be possible for an employee to basically do no work yet still receive the salary for 2 years?
I think that they could fire him for cause at some point, perhaps, but we never got to that issue. And so I'm really not, I don't know how the trial court would look at it if Your Honor finds this provision to be ambiguous and therefore a jury question. And remands to the trial court, I know we'll talk about other provisions, and the defense would be some form of poor performance that provoked them to fire him. So I'm not really prepared to concede that or agree with it or not, but I think it'll come up later if the court remands. And with that, I don't have any further, but I stand available for any questions.
All right, Mr. Olson, you've got 7 minutes and 8 seconds for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Greg Urich, and I represent United Food Service, which does business as Shamrock Foods. My registration number is 2622. I'd like to begin by responding to the court's order from last week asking us to address Dorman, because obviously that's on your minds and that's why we're here. Dorman, I think, is distinguishable because not only the fact that it found the language in question to be ambiguous, but because of the very specific terms of that letter agreement that it relied on in doing so. The question posed was, did Mr. Dorman have an employment contract for a definite term, or was there at least an ambiguity as to what the term of his employment was? And the court found, based on three terms, and I'm sure you've all noted, but I think they bear emphasizing. The first one is, although this contract commenced in August of 1991, it provided that the stock options that he was guaranteed couldn't be exercised until 3 years later, in 1994. So an inference could be drawn from that provision that it was intended that he work for at least 3 years so that guarantee of stock options were available to him. Secondly, the compensation schedule outlined about 3 years of compensation for Mr. Dorman, starting at an hourly rate in the first month, a flat salary the second month, a higher salary for 3 months after that, and then it prescribed the salary for 1992 and 1993, 2 and 3 years out in his employment at Petro Aspen. And Lastly, although I doubt it was a significant factor, there were some other terms that the court noted suggested that this contract could have been intended by both parties to extend beyond the period of time that he actually worked, that he was going to attend a seminar in Glenwood Springs, that he would do some training and so forth in the future. Now, the first point I would make about Dorman is it obviously is a case about ambiguity on the term of the contract. Counsel, the plaintiff, appellant, in every brief filed in the trial court and in this court and at this podium today, told you his position is there's no ambiguity. Dorman was about ambiguity about the term of the contract.
Are we bound by counsel's representation or his position that there's no ambiguity in the contract?
I don't think you're bound by it, but that certainly has been what the briefing has looked like all through this case. I think we're at a significant disadvantage if suddenly Mr. Olson takes the position, oh, this is ambiguous. I don't think the case has been fairly presented, but I don't think you're bound by it, Judge Terry. But the important thing about this letter agreement is that in stark contrast to Dorman, there isn't a single date out into the future when something is projected to happen. There are employee benefits, which have some vesting periods, which would be generally applicable to all employees. But there's nothing that's going to happen in the future with a date that one might infer from that the contract was intended to last that at least that long. The second factor that's a dramatic difference from Dorman is the last language of the compensation paragraph that I'm sure you've read, but bear with me. It says compensation will be administered utilizing the salary policy guidelines and will only be paid while you remain actively employed by Shamrock Food Company.
Well, counsel, I have a question about that, Mr. Urick, because that language was not contained in the complaint. And as I understand it, the letter was not attached to the complaint either. So aren't we bound just by what the allegations were of the complaint?
No, Your Honor, we've cited in our brief to authority of the Colorado Appellate Courts that basically says if a contract and its terms are relevant in examining the well-pleaded allegations of the complaint, that it's incorporated into the complaint for purposes of ruling on a motion to dismiss, as are documents that are referenced in it. And I think you'll find that at pages 2 and 3 of our brief. And so,
Mr. Urick, excuse me, the Illinois cases that were cited in the reply brief, they had language more like this contract rather than Dorman, and so should those be considered instructive?
Well, it's Illinois law.
Right.
I don't know what other peculiarities there might be under Illinois law, so it's obviously not controlling. Is it instructive? No, because those contracts did not have this provision about the fact that he had to be actively employed to be paid. That's a fairly logical provision, but it's also the kind of protective provision that didn't get put in the contract in Dorman, that didn't get put in the two contracts at issue in the two Illinois cases, and which I think makes all the difference here. If you interpret this contract in all of its terms and don't ignore any of them, I don't know how you can read that sentence and conclude that this man gets paid after his termination.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Urick, but if I understand it correctly, and if I'm wrong, please enlighten me, but if I understand it correctly, the actively employed language is in the letter, right?
Right.
What if we don't consider the letter? What do we look at then?
If you don't consider the letter, I've got a problem. I will readily confess that. I think based on, but there really is no contract in front of you at that point. All we've got is a bad allegation that he was entitled to be paid for 2 years. And I guess that means we go back to the trial court and do discovery and then tee up this issue on summary judgment. But I think the law is clear in Colorado that you do consider the contract that this case is based on, and that is a permissible submission with a motion to dismiss based on the cases that we've cited. And given the language that I've talked about, which is that he has to be actively employed, The plaintiff has suggested no explanation for what that means in this context other than what I have suggested. He cited no authority that has such language in it. And he doesn't claim that we couldn't fire him. He simply claims that if we do fire him, we're obliged to pay out the full 2 years of the salary guarantee, even though he didn't have an employment guarantee. But at that point, after we terminate his employment, he's no longer actively employed. And by the clear language of that agreement, he's not entitled to get paid. And counsel doesn't explain how that works to his benefit. So if you read the contract as a whole and you get the meaning to all of its terms, and you apply the presumption of employment at will that is applicable in Colorado, Mr. Pizarro was guaranteed a salary for as long as he worked for Shamrock. But when he's no longer actively employed, he's not entitled to receive that compensation.
Mr. Urich, I'd like to go back to the discussion that you had of Dorman, if I could. You mentioned 3 points, and you indicated that the third were some other terms that you didn't think were particularly necessarily dispositive. You also mentioned the stock option piece, which commenced in 1991, et cetera. Now, is it your position that because there are no stock options in this case that, let me back up and say, were the stock options a necessary part of the Supreme Court's decision in Dorman?
My reading of that case, Judge Terry, is any one of the first 2 points they relied on probably were sufficient. The stock options that were exercisable not for 3 whole years, and a salary schedule that specified each month and each year out 3 years. I think either one of those, but I'm trying to get behind the minds of the Colorado Supreme Court, and that's a risky proposition. But it seems to me that either would be sufficient.
I tend to read it the same way, that the stock options aren't necessary. It really relies on these 4 provisions: the hourly basis for August 1991, $1,500 for September 1991, $3,600 for November, December 91. I mean, it seems to me that that piece by itself would be sufficient for the court to have said that the agreement was fairly susceptible to the interpretation that he was being offered employment at least through January 1994. Now, where I'm having a problem, Mr. Urich, is discerning any serious difference between those provisions and the provision that was quoted in the complaint from the letter, that is, salary guarantee of $100,000 per year or $8,334 per month for 2 years. Can you help me, please, with that?
The 2 years phrase, that's problematic, because we know from Justice versus Stanley Aviation that simply reciting an annual salary is not sufficient.
Well, I'm not so sure that the Supreme Court was persuaded by Justice. It's cited in Dorman. It says the Court of Appeals, relying on Justice, concluded that a commitment on the duration of employment cannot be inferred from a contract provision fixing the rate of compensation during a given year. And then it goes on to pretty much do what it's going to do. So I don't know that it's finding Justice to be, well, it's certainly the Supreme Court was not bound by Justice, but I don't think necessarily we are either. For one thing, we're not bound by a decision of another division of this court, but we are bound by the Supreme Court's decision, and so I'm trying to figure out if there's really any difference between the fact situation in Dorman and the situation we have here.
I don't think the Supreme Court in Dorman rejected Justice. I think Justice still stands as good law, and I think there's a lot of law around the country, and including in Colorado, that says an annual salary standing alone isn't enough. What's different in Dorman, and I absolutely agree with you, Judge Terry, is this schedule of compensation going out a number of years. And I understand the argument that the phrase for 2 years complicates this and brings it a little closer to Dorman. But Dorman doesn't have the language that says, you got to be working for us. We're not going to pay you if you're no longer employed. That would have been the sort of protective provision that would have caused the Dorman case to die in the district court. And that's the sort of protective provision that my client put in this agreement so that they wouldn't have to pay somebody for not working. That's the way you solve that problem. And that's the way you create a contract, I think, that is unambiguous about the fact that you get this guarantee only as long as you're still employed. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but those are my comments.
We have no further questions for you, counsel. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Olson, you've got 7 minutes and 8 seconds. Thank you, sir. And because you have a fair amount of time, I'm going to hit you with a question right out of the box, if I may, please. I want you to address what effect the actively employed language has on your argument that this is not ambiguous for your side of things.
That term is meant to apply with the fact pattern that Judge Boras mentioned, and that is the employee fails to come to work. That would be interpreted as he's no longer employed. He's certainly not employed doing his job. He's just staying home. We think that is an avenue by which this company could protect itself from an employee who did that. That doesn't open the door.
Well, are you saying an employee who, this only refers to employees who basically quit while still pretending to be on the job, as opposed to, let's assume, and I know this is not the case, so this is a hypothetical, and I'm not casting aspersions at Mr. Passara. This does not have anything to do with him. Let's assume that you have an employee who is stealing, and it's clear, it's unambiguous, and you have the same contract, and they fire him. You are stealing from us. Does that employee get 2 years of $100,000, even if he's caught stealing 3 months into it?
That back pattern that you presented incorporates or would incorporate all kinds of other legal arguments, including equitable arguments, arguments involving criminal conduct as affect a contract, whether enforcing a contract when one of the parties participating in criminal conduct is unconscionable or negates the contract. So I'm not sure it really applies to the situation.
Okay, he's drunk on the job, or he does something that's not a crime, but is very clearly an appropriate basis for dismissing him.
Well, we'd have to look to other terms of the contract, and we would have to look to the extrinsic evidence of what these two parties intended. But this fact pattern comes before the court on a very, very narrow basis, a motion to dismiss in which all facts and reasonable inferences therefrom should fairly have been taken in favor of the non-movement. Based upon the wording of the complaint, the court didn't reach the issue of ambiguity, and so even that issue may not reasonably be before the court. The court simply looked at that sentence and said it doesn't negate employment rule in Colorado, and I think that's a principle of law that would absolutely wreak havoc in interpretation of contract principles in the state of Colorado hereafter if that is upheld by the court. Looking at that language, once again, it's also noteworthy that the sentence itself says $100,000 per year, and then it doesn't stop there. That's the language that did not affect the employment at will situation in other cases in Colorado, but then went on to add additional language, and that term year shows up again in the plural for 2 years. And I believe the court should find that every phrase in a contract deserves finding of import, especially when interacting with other phrases in the contract. It's an interesting situation where you look at this and you say to yourself, but is it possible that it's so obvious that we're reading things into it we shouldn't be reading into it? Our view of the evidence as applied to this case is that this is the way people talk, this is the way they write their contracts, and that is a term of 2 years, and there's no way around it in our view. And with that, I have nothing further.
Counsel, thank you very much for your argument. The case will stand submitted, and the opinion will issue in due course. Because that is our only oral argument this afternoon, the bailiff can announce the recess. Safe journey home, everybody.